Blog Talk Radio.
All right, I guess that's a good place to start right there. How's it going, everybody? We are back. It's been a while, and we finally can't take it anymore. We've had enough, and we just have to do one of these podcasts. And by we, I mean myself, Chris Block. How you doing? And my good friend here, Al Simaglia. Al, it's been a long time. Not for us personally. We have these cathartic conversations usually over cell phone. But now we're going to do here, and we're going to let people listen in. Oh, wait a minute. It would help if I unmuted you.
Chris. It's good to let some of this out before I have a stroke. So it was getting into the red line area, and we'll see what happens here. Although most people won't like to hear what I have to say, probably I feel I have to say it.
Well, that's most people's response when they listen to you, but
that's true.
This is
true. Nothing new.
It's not that much different with me. So we don't. There's so much ground to cover here. Obviously, we haven't. I was thinking about this for some reason. I thought that we had done a podcast within the last year, and that's not true, unless I'm missing something. It's been a while. I think it was March of something or November of 2020. It was when the Blackhawks came out and said that they were going to be transparent with their fan base. You remember that? Remember those days?
they were going to
Dan Bowman, and they were going to be transparent. And if you recall, that was a rebuild. Remember that? That was a rebuild.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Remember?
And not a retool.
But that was the last podcast we did. The last one I did was actually with Hockey Night over the first. That's the one I was thinking about. But one of the reasons why it's been I've been wanting to do this is because obviously I think a lot of people might be interested to hear my perspective on the Jenner and Block investigation, and obviously Kyle Beach coming out and disclosing that he was John Doe, one of the two John Does. And I will get to that. I can add some perspective to it. We'll get to that. But first and foremost, I guess, in the terms of the topical conversation, is the NHL trade deadline just passed the other day. Historical purposes, we are recording this podcast on March 24th, 2022. And the trade deadline had passed. Kyle Davidson, who was the last man standing in the Blackhawks phony search for a general manager. He made a few deals, most significantly, I think, trading Marc-Andre Fleury to the Minnesota Wild for a conditional first-round draft pick that more than likely, unless the Minnesota Wild wind up in the Western Conference Final, will be a second-round pick. And we'll talk about that. And then, of course, the other one, I guess, would be Brandon Hagel, which happened a few days before the deadline in a trade that I think shocked some people, being dealt in quite a big move, just in terms of size, to the Tampa Bay Lightning for a couple of future first-round picks and a couple of players, Taylor Radish and Boris Tkachuk. And then Ryan Carpenter going to Calgary for a fifth-round pick, I believe, providing some depth there for Daryl Sutter and the Calgary Flames. Your general thoughts on all of that, Al?
I think as it ended up, the Fleury trade was a fair trade. And I thought from the beginning there wouldn't be a long list of teams that, for one reason or another, either could afford him or he would want to go to. And I think, you know, reading between the lines and pretty much what everyone seems to think, there was really one buyer at the end. So to pull off the trade, I think that's a good thing. I think the way it went about was kind of backwards and really nonsensical. To play him in the game before And to watch him flopping around in the crease without his glove as a puck whistled by, I mean, I know there was, you know, some story floated out there that Davidson was trying to muscle Guerin into, you know, blinking and making the trade sooner and giving up a first round. I mean, Davidson really wasn't in a position to muscle anyone. He only had one buyer left. And actually, what he did by playing for Fleury made no sense at all if there was any kind of chance that there would be a deal, because if he would have gotten hurt, he would have gotten nothing, and Fleury would have not gotten a chance to carry on with the team that had a chance in the playoffs, which is the other side of it. Actually, if he wanted to bluff, he should have scratched him. Because then, to those on the outside, it may look like there was more than one buyer, that it wasn't just Guerin. So to me, it made no sense to play him. They were fortunate, and maybe finally the hockey gods are finally turning a little bit, because if that puck hits him in the bare hand, they're in trouble. And then a lot of questions would have had to been answered. So what they wound up getting, I think it was a fair deal. Do I think they could beat Colorado, as it seems like they would have to? No. But it's a great trade for Billy Guerin from the standpoint that he wants this team to play playoff games. They're kind of ahead of the curve. He's going to be out. He's going to be under a big load with the cap situation in the next few years. You know, he wants to take a swing, and I think it's a smart trade for him. The other trade with Hagel, interestingly enough, the day after the trade, their lead analyst on TV, which is Colby Cohen, comes out and says the reason that the trade was tiered into 23 and 24 draft picks is because that gives Davidson a chance to rebuild his scouting staff. Now, I wasn't crazy about the trade to begin with, because if you think about it in probabilities, when you're drafting at the end of the round, you're hoping to get a player as good as Brandon Hagel. They already had that. So the key to the deal is not the two draft picks, and the more valuable of the two is the one that's further out, because by that time, maybe it could be a mid-first-round pick if Tampa Bay kind of slides. The key to the trade, in my view, is getting the two-for-one now. And interestingly enough, there are two $750,000 players, and Hagel's making $1.5 million. See how that works, Chris? So the other thing is,
yeah, I mean,
the other thing too is that they gave up two players that didn't fill that third line role need for them, for one that they're pretty sure will. So, in my way of thinking about it, anybody could have traded Brandon Hagel. He didn't need to be traded right away, but they wanted to get multiple players back. They wanted to get draft picks back, and he was really their only shot to do that in that way, which says something else about the organization. He was really the only other player beside Carpenter that I thought could be traded. I didn't see anyone reaching for DeHaan. Kubalik is a load at $4 million a year. So I cut you off a little bit. You finish up. But my thinking is that this trade is dependent on those two young guys becoming players. Otherwise, it's a wait and see for the draft picks for 4 years or something until they could play.
All right, I don't know what happened there. You hear it, Al?
Yeah, where did it cut out?
Well, I dropped off.
Do we
right
know?
As I was right. Well, no, right as I was joining is when I dropped off. Okay, so I'll clean that up after the fact.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You finish up that. Okay.
I'll clean up after the fact. To your point about Colby Cohen, and I think you and I have talked about this, and you're of the belief that that's something that was sort of fed to him. I can see that. I don't think Colby Cohen is really, and the reason why they like Colby Cohen is he's not in a position really, he's not going to talk out of school. He's afraid to say much of anything that would be deemed as critical or anything of that sort. But I also think Colby Cohen is one of the reasons why they like him is that he says things that he believes that'll be received well by the people that employ him. So I think he could have also just been speaking off the cuff as well. I could see it both ways. My whole thing on the draft picks, though, from Tampa is, I think, because I'm not buying this whole rebuild nonsense, because there's two things that are going to happen this summer. Number one, they are about to bleed thousands of season ticket holders. They're going to have a lot of people not renewing. So that's a reality that's about to slap them in the face. Secondly, a lot of what they're doing right now is not just putting Kyle Davidson in a position where, okay, he's our general manager, we're going to rebuild, and it's going to be in his vision and his team, and he's going to get to hire all these people. I think Kyle Davidson, I think he got a good return for Hagel, and if the assessment is that this is the best Brandon Hagel that there will ever be, you know, I don't know what his shooting percentage is off the top of my head, but it's a very good shooting percentage. It's not something that he'll probably ever be able to – he'll never be able to stay at that pace. But if your assessment is this is the best Brandon Hagel that there'll ever be, then this is the appropriate time to trade him, okay? And not a decent return. Maybe I think there's problems with Taylor Radish's game when he, you know, away from the puck, defensive zone awareness, being lazy, just in situational awareness sense. But offensively, he's a decent player. I don't think really Tkachuk will really amount to anything. But if you get one of those two guys becomes a decent contributor for a little while during your rebuild, that's fine. Because what's more important is those two draft picks. I think that jumping the gun, perhaps, on the Brandon Hagel trade, because Brandon Hagel could be a guy that you could build around, or he's a guy, not build around, that's the wrong way to say it, but you need guys in your transition during your rebuild, so to speak, to set a tone, to set an example, to be leaders. And DeBrinket and Hagel, those are two guys in the forward side that could do that for you. And so to jump the gun in a way, or perhaps on the Hagel trade, says to me that getting those picks now is important for some reason. And the reason why I think it's important is because Kyle Davidson is never going to use those two draft picks. Kyle Davidson will not be the general manager that makes those two draft picks. I believe that the reason to get those picks now is because he's going to use those this coming summer, whether it's to aggressively pursue another player or to move up in the 2022 draft. I think that's what's going to be, because I just don't look at this situation and see that there's any other result than this summer. I don't think Kyle Davidson's the guy that's going to wait 2 years to whip his big, impressive brain out on the table and tell you about how amazing and impressive it is. I just don't see that's going to happen. They will be aggressive this summer, and we'll be sitting here, maybe even doing a podcast in mid-July, and we'll be talking about how the Blackhawks are talking about how excited they are for this team and how their rebuild is ahead of schedule. I just don't see this going any other way. So that's, I think, with the Hagel trade, that was the reason for the Hagel trade, is because they're going to, for all the talk about taking time and all that, they're going to expedite this. And the other reason why I think they're going to expedite it is the most obvious thing that nobody's talking about is, why bury Lucas Reichel in the minors to preserve a year of his entry-level deal if you're going into a rebuild? There's no reason for it. The only reason to preserve that his entry-level deal and to get Reichel on the cheap, perhaps, if he becomes a good, you know, the good player that we think he's going to be, the only reason to do that is if in 3 years you're thinking that you're going to need him on that low number. If this is a 4 or 5 year rebuild, there's no reason to preserve his entry level. So, I mean, you gotta connect the dots here.
How do you do that though? I mean, you trade a 23. I see your point, but I can't connect anything. You trade a 23-year-old guy who comes out of left field and is way more than you thought he was going to be, that you had controlled for $1.5 million for 2 years, for draft picks that you're probably going to trade into a shallow draft to acquire someone in this draft with the hopes they become Brandon Hagel, and your scouting staff is still in disarray. When those decisions should be made now.
Is the scouting staff in disarray?
Well, when you let the guy who was the guru, when you let Kelly go, and the other guy, the head pro scout, now you have another situation where you have people underneath them that have been following their orders for a number of years. See, that's what's backwards with this whole thing, and really it's very difficult to get any optimism unless they could somehow lure enough experience here. Because what it is now, they were in over their eyeballs in Stan Bowman. Stan Bowman's performance declined. And as it declined, they became more dependent upon him. They gave him another title. They put him in a situation where they restructured so that he could layer underneath him. And the more you do that when you're on top, that insulates you. Okay? That's corporate 101. So they go from one assistant GM to three or four assistant GMs. They keep the same scouting in place that hasn't really done well in years. And then they don't look for another GM right away. They give someone supposed full authority immediately who never had any experience except he was there and he was Stan Bowman's guy. They gave him supposedly full authority. He doesn't fire the scouts right away and try to build something up here so that you have a chance by the trade deadline to have some different input and also set yourself up for the draft. He does just the opposite. He fires the two guys on top. What message does that send everyone else who's here?
Well, they were
scapegoats. And then he goes and makes the easy – well, right. And then he trades the easiest guy on the roster to trade, Brandon Hagel, right away. So, I mean, it's I understand what you're saying, and I don't disagree with any of it. And if what you're saying is that maybe there's a chance one of those guys becomes a third or fourth line player, I mean, who advised on taking those two guys? Florida made the trade with Philadelphia. They picked a kid out of the minors who had like 18 points in the last 12 games. They took a minor leaguer. Who advised on taking Radish and Kachuk? Scotty Bowman? Is he still on call? He goes to the games in Florida, I know, once in a while. I don't know since COVID. But, I mean, who advised on taking those two players? Who was in the mix on that? And, you know, so I see where people want to be optimistic, and I'm not hanging Davidson out to dry. I said I would reserve judgment, but the Hagel trade, I mean, really, it's not like it was a windfall. If I'm Tampa Bay, I'm doing that trade all the time. And this theory of, well, they'll pay for it someday could be quite a while away because they know how to draft in the third and fourth rounds. So the Hawks, they forgot
how to develop. And they know how to develop.
And they don't develop. And they don't know how to develop, right. So that's the key. People say, well, the Blackhawks are paying for their success now. No, they're not paying for their success now because they traded a ton of number one picks away. I think they only traded two away in 10 years up until Jones. But what they didn't do was they didn't develop anyone. So they didn't develop your depth players. So they weren't the Pittsburgh Penguins. So you have to go out and overpay for those players and are too heavily dependent upon a smaller group of higher-end players on your team. They weren't the Penguins. They weren't the Bruins. They didn't draft well. They didn't rebuild when maybe rebuild with air quotes around it, maybe after they got or start to think about it when they got eliminated from Nashville. They didn't stockpile picks like they did in L.A. They don't have the coaching and the development that they do in L.A. and you could see what they're doing now with their two best defensemen or their two most offensive defensemen, one out for the entire year and the other one missing time. I heard Todd McClellan yesterday, and he said they chose, because of the character of the veteran players, that they wanted them to be to influence the younger players and to build with them. So in other words, Doughty, who everyone thought was washed up, Kopitar, who everyone thought was washed up, Dustin Brown, Quick, they wanted those players to stay because they had them believing, because they had a ton of prospects, and even the amateur analyst said their prospects were far above almost everyone else in depth and everything else. But you still have to know how to use them and allocate them. And they got coaches behind the bench. And that's the problem here. It's not only with the micro view of decisions and everything happened subsequently from Kyle Beach and what should have happened without any Kyle Beach incident. It's the macro view, the systemic view of where are the coaches with experience. They got a guy behind the bench now that they didn't have the guts to make the head coach because of his history. And no one else really wanted to hire him to be an assistant. They have Derek King, who's a career minor league assistant. Nice guy. Seems, you know, probably a good guy to go out and have a joke, you know, crack a few jokes and have a beer. The guy in the minor leagues, is he off the mission tree, Stan Bowman's mission tree? You know, he never had any experience coaching in the AHL and the NHL as a head coach, I don't believe. Where are the scouts? They have some people that seem they should have the know-how, but again, no experience. So somehow, some way, example, what did the Los Angeles Kings do? They got Rob Blake, okay? And what did they see? Well, they saw that he's kind of an inexperienced GM. And then they also have, and his name escapes me, the player that played out there that was a great scorer, Luke Robitaille. He's also in the front office. So when they had the opportunity, they didn't look to shield themselves. They got another strong guy in. They went and hired Bergevin because he knows how to be a GM. You may not agree with all his moves, but he's a good guy to lean on. We don't have – what did the Hawks do? They hired back the guy that was demoted by Stan Bowman. Into a higher position after they demoted them into a higher position. So, I mean, you know, I come across as being negative, but really if you look at this in totality, I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
I dropped for a minute there, so I missed some of what you said, but – I don't know why I'm having technical difficulties here, but hopefully we'll be able to clean this up in post-production. Had the Jenner and Block and the Brad Aldrich and Kyle Beach thing not gone down, okay? I mean, because so much happened, and it was emotional for a lot of people. But we forget that Stan Bowman wasn't fired for bad performance. He was fired because the Blackhawks had no other choice. So, right. One of the things that we can get to Rocky Wirtz's neutering of the Chicago sports media in a minute, but. One of the things that I would ask if I had a forum and Rocky and Danny Wirtz would come out of hiding, is at what point did you become disenchanted with Stan Bowman's performance as a general manager? Because that's not why they fired him. And at what point did you decide that there needed to be an organization overhaul? And my point about this is, just like you just referenced Norm McIver being demoted, when they went into their transparency phase and like you remember,
not hearing you, buddy.
All right. So one of the things I don't know why I keep dropping. So one of the things that he had said, Sam Bowman had said in that podcast, was that they had been rebuilding for 2 years. His exact quote is, "We've been rebuilding for 2 years. We're just being transparent about it now." So Sam Bowman's idea mm-hmm. of a rebuild wasn't to tear it down and rebuild it. It was to do little things on the fly and then sell you on hope, right? And
like $11 million worth of goalies and things like that.
Right. And their constant belief internally was that they were better than they were, or that it wasn't their fault and they were actually a better team than they were showing. But somebody had to pay for those things, right? So the demotion of Norm McIver. Had Stan Bowman and none of this stuff happened with Jenner and Block and Aldrich coming out and all that, if Stan Bowman was still the general manager, I think that Mark Kelly and Ryan Stewart getting fired would have happened anyway. So, those are things that were probably in the pipeline anyway. And also, you can't say, because they're going to sell you on these prospects, right? Alex Vlasic, Lucas Reichel, Nolan Allen, Wyatt Kaiser, who's a brilliant young defensive prospect. Okay, well, those are all Mark Kelly guys, right? So you can't have it both ways. You can't start to sell people on, we got these guys that we're really excited about coming up through the pipeline, and Mark Kelly was bad at his job and he had to be fired. Can't be both.
Yeah. Yeah, and he would have wound up firing. He would have had to fire Colleton, although that cost the organization years and years, to get a big brain guy in that only Stan Bowman saw as being an elite coach someday in the NHL. And he doubled down then, gives him the extension in COVID when other well-thought-of coaches had to wait to the end of the year to get extended. I mean, when you look at it, Stan had complete control over everything. I mean, he just did. Now, your point about would he have wound up firing Kelly? Yeah, maybe. He's been here a long time. Maybe he would have. There were enough people underneath him to fire to keep deflecting. That's the point. And I think that's the point, overriding point that you're making, and that's true. Because in all of this, no matter what Stan Bowman did, he was fortified. They just gave him more people to the cushion underneath him, restructure this, restructure that. And even when you look at this, I mean, no one knows for sure, but his house went up for sale in the summer. So maybe, finally something happened there where he thought something was going on. But the Hawks weren't going to let him go until they absolutely had to. I mean, there was no preemptive thinking here at all. When you let him go and make the most important trade the organization has made in, I don't know how long. I mean, I can't.
Well, no,
I don't
I mean,
even
definitely
know when.
The Seth Jones deal was an enormous deal that they. All right, I'm back. I don't know what's going on here. So, I mean, the internet connection is fine. So I don't know what's going on. Where was I? Well, I think we'll just use this to transition. So I think the next step here is to talk about where do they go from here? I mean, I think, and just knowing this organization, following it as closely as I have, being out and really being able to be close and analyze what they were doing in Rockford all these years, to both of our points before about, the most important thing here is development, because it's not that they traded away first round draft picks is the reason why the Blackhawks are in the position that they're in today. They're in the position that they're in today because they didn't develop Mark McNeil. They traded Philip Deneau. Kevin Hayes blossomed late, but he blossomed late. Dylan Olsen turned out to be a flop. And a lot of these mid-round guys didn't amount to anything. And that's right. The reason why they're in the position that they're in today. And this, getting back to Lucas Reichel, I mean, this idea of, okay, we're going to let our guys play in Rockford. We're going to let them season and all that kind of stuff. That's not anything different than what Stan Bowman used to say. Stan Bowman just didn't act on it. You know, anytime they got a guy that they were really excited about.
Because his hand was forced. Right.
Well, the guys that he drafted
that were very good came right up.
Right. They came up because they were excited about him and they didn't want him spending any time in Rockford. What about Alec Vlasic? This kid comes out of, you know, he's a decent, you know, young prospect that could amount to something. And did he go to Rockford? No. Now, there could be other circumstances. I mean, these negotiations sometimes, I mean, you know, there's sometimes that when a prospect signs, their agent wants to burn a year of their contract right away. Or, you know, sometimes, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why these things happen. But Alex Vlasic just bypassed so far, it's just bypassed Rockford and he's up in the NHL. So that's not following in the seasoning aspect. So the doublespeak is the continuation of the Stan Bowman era. And I don't buy it. I mean, to your point, they knew. You would have to believe, okay, that Danny Wirtz is utterly incompetent at his job, which is, that's a possibility, given that press conference or that town hall, that he's utterly incompetent in his position, that while this Jenner and Block report was going on and while these interviews were happening, that Danny, where you would have to believe that Danny Wirtz never walked down the hall and said, "Hey, Stan, let's talk. Tell me what you're going to tell Jenner and Block." And at that point, Danny would know, all right, I'm probably going to have to fire Stan. This probably doesn't end. And Danny probably calls up Gary Bettman and says, "Hey," or Rocky calls up Gary Bettman. It's like, all right, this is what's going to come out in this report. What do you think? And they all get together and it's like, there's no way. And probably what happened is Gary Bettman went to all these people, for everyone involved, including Joe Quenneville in Florida, and was like, we have to make this go away. So all these people have to go away. And from June or July, the Wirtzes knew how this was most likely, unless they were able to settle out of court and make the thing go away. If this thing came to its completion, they knew how this was going to turn out. And that's why I think the whole GM search was a fraud.
And you know what? It wasn't even like a settle out of court. Pardon me?
I'm still here, am I?
Oh, I see. That settle out of court, this was a unique situation where Beach's lawyer used a court of public opinion. They didn't want to go to court. They didn't need to. So it was going to settle out of court one way or the other, most likely from just the way it was as it presented itself. So
she had to get it out there because most likely it was going to get thrown out because of the statute of limitations.
Right, she almost identified him.
Well, to people
which
that
she gave in the interview, I mean,
I didn't like for to,
he was
to
playing
that,
where he was playing.
Right, really clear. I had no idea this was Kyle Beach until she started talking. At that point,
right,
I was like, oh my God. And at that point, like, and she outed the. I'm not going to name the other player, but she outed the other player too.
So right.
Like, once she started talking, I was like, oh, my God, I know who this is.
Right, and if Bettman goes and he's representing ownership, meaning all 32 teams,
and he says, hey, how do you think that vote would have went? They're going to say, do whatever is needed to get rid of this. This is a stink we don't want any part of, although you know maybe not the same, but other things have happened that shouldn't have, that you know, were covered up. And, you know, we already saw Bob Murray go bye-bye. And, you know, who knows what else will be a fallout with it. But the fact of the matter is, no one was going to feel sorry for the Blackhawks. No one was going to feel sorry for Quenneville. I mean, so they probably knew down deep, but that didn't stop them from keeping their guy in charge. And you know, the whole thing, I mean, they missed out, and I don't know if they ever had a chance, okay, but they missed out on hiring Gordon,
who has really a very strong resume, to be the general manager. They chose not to hire a president of hockey operations, although they relayered their organization before, and most teams are going with a president of hockey operations and general manager. They chose not to do that. So, I mean, now you look at the head coach thing, and you could probably talk about that, you know, as far as like how they kind of set the table for Colleton being able to move up with giving him the type of roster that could win a few rounds maybe in the playoffs. I don't understand why these young guys aren't coming up now. I mean, Murphy's hurt, these young D-men, the games mean nothing. Why not take a look
at least one of those, at least one of those young guys, at least one of those young guys, whether it's Phillips or or Mitchell or Galvis, one of those, this is the time to bring up one of those guys and move them. And one of the things that bothers me about like this stuff that's gotten out about Davidson's negotiations and things of that nature, like you think about Fleury, right? Like Davidson was willing to risk Fleury getting hurt. Okay, you focus because it happened in the game on and him losing his glove and potentially trying to make a save with his bare hand. I mean, he could have pulled a groin. Somebody could have – there could have been scramble around the net and somebody steps on the back of his – on the back of his ankle and his season's done, right? Anything could have happened. He was
– concussion,
The only thing – Sunday night against Winnipeg, the only value that Fleury had to the organization was as a trade asset. And Davidson was willing to risk that and get nothing at all for him over – what he perceived to be a negotiation tactic. Now, that makes me
think. After he okayed the trade.
Right. And then the other thing that he pulled, and this came out in Mike Russo's, at the Minnesota beat writer for The Athletic, that at the last minute, Davidson tried to hold the deal up for Kaapo Kähkönen, who was Minnesota's backup goalie, which, I mean, it would have been a nice addition because the Blackhawks' goaltending is, who knows what the plan is there. But at the last minute, he tried to pull a fast one and say, oh, I want your backup goalie too. But Guerin already had a deal in place for that contingent on the Fleury trade. And it just makes me wonder about these other deals that didn't happen. Like, I can believe that nobody wanted Calvin DeHaan. Calvin DeHaan is a defenseman from a bygone era. Okay? But there, you know, I could also think, well, if there's a contender out there that just needs bodies and just wants insurance, and the Blackhawks were willing to keep, you know, he's on an expiring deal anyway, but we're willing to keep some of the salary to make the deal work, that Calvin DeHaan could have pulled a fifth-round pick. You make that deal. You don't need Calvin DeHaan anymore. Or Dylan Strome. Or Dominic Kubalik. It makes me wonder if there were trades out there for those guys that have no, well, I don't. I'm not buying that Dylan Strome isn't part of the future. I don't think he should be, but I'm not buying that completely that he's not. But I wonder if there were trades out there for those guys, but that Davidson negotiated himself into an FU from the other general manager, because just at what's coming out about this thing with Minnesota, it just makes me wonder if he just, you know, is too big for his britches.
Well, you know, I caught some criticism because I said, you know, the Blackhawks need an exorcism on Twitter because no matter what they do, and the Fleury trade ended up being a good thing, they get criticized. The interesting thing of it all is, and what people don't seem to understand, could the story – here's how this could have went. I saw Dubas two interviews. He didn't bring up and say – you know, I wish those comments didn't come out of Chicago. He was asked. And one guy asked him and said, rumors down the road. Kevin Weeks said specifically, rumors out of Chicago. Okay? So now, could the Toronto reporter, and I don't think people understand, think the difference between the Bears media coverage and the Blackhawks media coverage, and then go it to the third power, okay? There's a lot of scrutiny on the Toronto Maple Leafs. So could the reporter have been in there, you know, and maybe did Dubas a favor so that he could deflect a little bit and ask him that question? I don't know. I guess it's possible. But I don't ever remember one GM throwing another GM under the bus for letting something to come out. And when he points back to Davidson in particular, whether Davidson let the rumor out or let the story out or try to plant a message or not, that's his mess to clean up, because he has no street cred. And you don't want to be distrustful. These GMs, they fall in line. They don't really try to bag anyone, because once your name is mud, people don't deal with you. And the last thing a guy that's trying to rebuild or to improve a team needs is for guys not to want to help, not necessarily to help him, not to want to deal with him.
Well, yeah, and I think first of all, my first impression of the whole guy, Kyle Dubas, being upset that his conversations with Kyle Davidson about Marc-Andre Fleury that ended up going nowhere, but his conversations about Marc-Andre Fleury with Davidson went public, to me, my first instinct is like it's overblown, because a lot of stuff gets out, you know, that doesn't happen. Most stuff that doesn't happen doesn't get out, but a lot of stuff does. So in my first reaction was that Dubas is probably being too sensitive, but I also think that it's just as likely that there was a real like sense of that conversation that Dubas was like, listen, I don't know that I can make this happen, so let's really keep this one under wraps, because because the context of that question, I was watching that press conference post trade deadline, and Dubas had just gone on like a 3 or 4 minute spiel about how confident that they were in Jack Campbell, how resilient Campbell has been through his career.
How he bounces back. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then he gets the question of, well, the rumors out of Chicago that you were talking about, you know, about Marc-Andre Fleury. And so you understand why he reacted the way that he did.
It was pointed directly out of Chicago. Right.
But this is
Kevin Weeks.
Right. But my other point about this is the problem when you have somebody in Kyle Davidson who is so woefully unqualified for the position that he's in, because he and other people around him are going to the media and really trying to present that he's good at his job and that he's active and he's working so hard. And so there's other forces at work here and the other thing too is, you notice how the Chicago media very rarely breaks any of these stories, because the Blackhawks go to the national media to get their stories out.
They plant them where they want to. Yeah, there's one guy locally that they seem to toss something through now and then. But you're right.
Right, and you know, Scott Powers gets some good stuff from now and then. But it's usually he has to bypass Chicago to get it, and I think he probably has a good source now, without going into it. But. That's the other thing that's at work here, is that you got to pump up Davidson to sell people on that he's the guy, when he's clearly woefully unqualified to do this. And he's being put in a position because the Wirtzes are comfortable with him, and he's a continuation of Stan Bowman. That's...
Yeah, I mean, I think there was, even with the way Davidson answered, I mean, he answered, well, yeah, I'll talk to him in private. All he had to say
they probably already had the conversation. That's the other thing I thought, too.
Yeah.
They probably already had the conversation, and because it was a couple days old by that point. It just – that was the first chance somebody had to ask Dubas about
it. It just all smells. I mean, the other thing, too, is, you know, this stuff comes out, you know, it's better, you know, locally. There's a lot of in-town stupid here now, too. You know, they use the expression out of town stupid. It's very difficult to cover all the teams and to have an angle on them. It's just very hard. In town, it's still not easy, and you're limited in some respects, but some of this stuff that it's better for the Blackhawks, for their young players to play more minutes in Rockford than it is for them to play 13 minutes in Chicago. No, no, no. This is the time of the year where the games don't really matter. You get a look at them, and it bolsters them, either bolsters them to come back stronger the following year in training camp, or they know what they need to work on. You could expound upon this. I won't. But maybe you could explain in 90 seconds some of the differences between AHL hockey and NHL hockey. Even though it's supposed to be the breeding ground for younger players, it's a far different game. So,
well, number one,
the organization that had far too many defensemen at one time, young defensemen. Now you're trying to find some, and you better identify them because the defense is it's a horror show. They have a wrong mix of people. When you look at your second best defenseman is not Larry Murphy, Connor Murphy, and he's limited on special, can't play the power play at all, and he's a limited penalty killer. That's not a good mix. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think the number one difference is the speed at which the play moves, because the passing is just so much better at the NHL level. And a lot of guys have issues right. when they make that step because of – and you see it. And you see it in a lot of guys that are on the Blackhawks right now is that they're fine when they play a dump-and-chase game. When it's just north-south, ship the puck, go get it, that's where they're comfortable, that's where they excel. But anything beyond that, they're in big trouble. But, you know, this whole idea of letting guys play in the minors, it all comes down to what are they doing in the minors. Like, I covered guys like Jeremy Morin and Brandon Peary and Mark McNeil and Beach and all these guys. And it really matters what they're doing and what kind of minutes they're playing. Because one of, like, let's just talk about Morin, for example, because he was sort of the classic example and the guy that I was always asked about. You know, he was scoring goals in the AHL. He was an offensive player. But it also came at a time when it was really, really difficult, a couple of those years anyway, to crack the Chicago Blackhawks lineup. They were in transition at the time, if you recall. They were going from – they were in between the 2010 and the 2013 Cup. So there was positions mm-hmm. there for him, but the knock against Morin was that he needed to be better defensively. Well, the minutes that he was getting in Rockford were all 5-on-5 and power play minutes. He very rarely played the penalty kill. He was very rarely on the ice in a defensive situation at the end of a hockey game. So how do you expect him to develop these other skills if you've never put him in a position to fail? And that's the
yeah,
whole point.
Yeah, if you don't put them in an uncomfortable position, they don't learn. Right.
Right, and that's the whole purpose of development, is that is an opportunity to really give these guys an opportunity to the tools and the space to grow. Because night to night, it doesn't matter whether or not the Rockford IceHogs win as long as their prospects are progressing. Yeah, you want it. It does matter, I think, to be in the hunt, and as you go towards the end of the season, to be in contention for the playoffs. And it's great if you can get into the playoffs and your prospects can have that experience. Financially, it's terrible. The AHL teams lose tons of money when it comes to playoff time. But for the development of the prospects, I think it's important. I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again because it backs up what I just said. The last time that I ever talked to Jeremy Colliton, which was an interview that I conducted with him in a morning skate on the Saturday before Joel Quenneville got fired. And it was a one-on-one conversation that I had with Colliton. I liked Colliton. I always found him to be somewhat engaging. He was very polite. I think there was a smugness to him, but usually you got an answer to the question that you asked. And I asked him a question about, at the time, the guy that was in the Jeremy Morin position was Dylan Sakura. Now, if you recall Dylan Sakura, I forget the offseason, but the season that the Blackhawks didn't really do anything at the trade deadline. And that was the year that Dylan Sakura was coming out of college. And Stan Bowman actually tried to sell that their deadline acquisition was going to be Dylan Sakura out of Northeastern. So Dylan Sakura did come, and he went right to the NHL roster, and he didn't do anything because he wasn't ready. So the next year he winds up in Rockford. And he's up and down, but he's mostly in Rockford. And I had this conversation with Colleton. I said, you know, one of the knocks on Sakura is his details away from the puck, his compete level away from the puck, and, you know, sort of defensive mindset. You know, he's shaking his head, yeah. And I said, you know, in college, Dylan Sakura played on the penalty kill. Now, college is different than NHL, AHL. Like, in college, the penalty kill tends to be more aggressive. You have offensive players on the penalty kill at times. He's shaking his head, yes. And I said, but in Rockford specifically, if you're trying to get Dylan Sakura to be more defensively aware and more responsible and have that kind of develop more of those attributes, don't you think it would be beneficial for him to play on the penalty kill here in Rockford? And Colleton, I'll never forget this, Colleton sort of looks at me, sort of kind of looks off into the distance, and he goes, it could. And then he goes off on a spiel about, you know, that this is, you know, we're the details and you can do those things 5-on-5. And I said, well, if you're really trying to challenge somebody, I didn't say this to him. I went on to my next question, but I'm thinking, like, if you're really trying to challenge somebody, put them in an uncomfortable position. It doesn't matter, you know, and, you know, that's
Colleton was a young Ralph Krueger. He was a young Ralph Krueger. Everybody liked listening to him talk. Not sure exactly what he was saying sometimes, but the players evidently didn't understand what he was saying. Another big brain guy that, you know, unfortunately, you know, maybe someday he will be able to coach in the NHL. I would think he's going to go overseas. But, I mean, it just shows, though, that's just some of the organization. I remember distinctly, I think Stan Bowman did pretty much verbatim say that was the deadline acquisition.
He did.
Dylan Sakura. Yeah.
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 And that's an organization that doesn't evaluate its own very well. And a larger point that I think that they've been doing, and this has got to change, like going forward, this has to change, is not only this, the whole concept of these guys playing in the minors, because a lot of these guys, I talked to them over and over again. One of the things that it felt kind of silly to me over time, but the more and more I thought about it, I was getting something out of asking these guys, like, so, you know, if they go up to Chicago, whether it was after training camp or if they got a call up, I said, so what it like, did you have a discussion with, you know, Joel or, you know, anybody in management that said, what do you need to work on down here? And a lot of, you know, some of the guys, you know, would have insightful answers and some wouldn't, but a lot of these guys, Mark McNeil, Sean Lalonde, you know, I could go on, but those are two guys specifically, Brandon Peary as well, that they just felt like they were just punching a time clock, that eventually their time would come and they just had to wait and just keep playing and putting in the time and the call would come. And it's just the wrong mentality. You got to blame the players a little bit, but these are young guys and it's a tone that's being set somewhere. And this Davidson being out and these people being out in the front office and just saying, like, these guys, we're going to let these guys play in the minors, we're going to let them bake. And if they overripen, they overripen, but the experience in the minors is what matters. The more and more they say that, the more the mentality is going to be in Rockford that you're just punching a time clock and your time will come. And that's the wrong tone to set. And because that's part of the reason why you're at where you're at now, because you didn't develop these guys. You had them in Rockford. You didn't develop them. And the other problem is that they get bored with their own prospects very easily. I mean, just don't look any further than Jokiharu or Boqvist. They get bored with their own prospects very easily. And some of the guys that are in Rockford right now, like Mitchell, that probably they were so excited about Mitchell, and then he came up and he wasn't ready, and now they're not as excited about these other guys. You know, And, yeah.
It's repeated and repeated.
So that's what has to change. You need a complete overhaul of your development coaches. You need coaches. Okay. No offense to Anders Sorensen. First of all, Anders Sorensen is a Stan Bowman guy. Okay. Through and through. That's a Stan Bowman guy. And so your buddy, Alex Nylander, that, you know who the Blackhawks fans have to thank for Alex Nylander is Anders Sorensen. Anders Sorensen was the guy that said, I can, you know, if we can get him into camp, and because Sorensen was the one that said that, you know, he knew how to get Nylander back on track and playing his best hockey, and that didn't work out. And Sorensen had him in Rockford directly. It wasn't just about training camp. He had all that time with him, and he couldn't do it. But that was a Sorensen thing. But they need to completely overhaul their development system and the mentality and the way that they use these players in Rockford. Challenge them, put them in uncomfortable positions, and stop with this reaffirmation process of creating an evaluation in your own mind and then reaffirming it over and over again with how you deploy these players, because that's why you're in the position that you're in.
Well, I think if you look at it, it should kind of scare fans from the standpoint that some of the better players that have come up and have been impressive, so to speak, were players that were never pumped up. You know, it's like
they caught them by surprise.
I mean,
Hagel, Andrew Shaw.
Caught them by complete surprise. You know, even like other people, Pronman, the guy that writes the prospects for quite a while, I mean, his opinion of Hagel was he didn't think he was an NHL player. He would play overseas probably. And you know, a lot of that info is coming to them from people they talk to within the Blackhawks. I mean,
it's impossible for him to watch all these prospects. Yes.
Yeah, and you know, in the last couple of years, it's been impossible for the scouts to see a lot of them either. So, you know, that word, that's just not his opinion. It's people that he trusts to know or people that he relies on. But it's again and again. So you don't see the succession that you would normally want to see. And players sour in the minors too. You know, if they don't have a direction, you know, at some point they don't get any better. And so that's another thing. But I don't know, you know, like the next coach, who's the next coach going to be? The only guy out there that I could think of that may take the job that has some decent experience would be David Quinn. Would he want to come here? I don't know, maybe. But
well, that's just the thing. I mean, if it's a true 4 or 5 year rebuild with this organization, with its recent track record, who are you going to get to take this job? Because whoever you get to take the job knows that they're not going to be the coach when the team is a playoff team. You know,
and you
got
to sign them, and you probably got to give them a 5-year contract or a 4-year contract at least,
which is not what they do. They give out 3-year contracts. So, yeah, I mean, and that's another reason why it's going to become clear to them pretty quickly that whether they're saying it publicly or they're saying it behind the scenes to potential people coming into the organization, it's like, yeah, we think that this is going to be a lot quicker. You know, like it's just going to happen. It's formality.
Well, if they don't pull the linchpin, if Kane says, you know, I'll stay. If he stays,
but if you wanted Kane to stay,
then
wouldn't you have made Pat Verbeek the general manager? Like, wouldn't you Pat Verbeek was on the broadcast for the Blackhawks played in Anaheim on Wednesday night, the night before we were recording this, and they had Verbeek on there, and they talked about his connection to Kane. He was Kane's billet in Michigan when Kane was 14 years old, and they have a good relationship and they still do to this day. I mean, if you wanted Kane, that's another thing. I mean, it's like Pat Verbeek is a guy that has done his time. He's learned and he's ready for this job. He's a good hockey mind. Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he's a former player and all that, but it was his time. He's paid his dues. And he has that connection to Kane. And the Hawks weren't ready. They weren't ready for that. You know,
I think he's, if he is in control of his destiny, stays and wants to stay. Now Taves is another thing because I think the underlying there's, you know, some health, mental issues with what's happened over the last year or so, you know, maybe, you know, the game started to wear on him, whatever it could be, you know, he started to play better, you know, but I think if they're going to rebuild, I mean, they'd have to sit down with him and say, you know, you're the third line center, which there should be nothing to be embarrassed about at his age. I mean, the players he admired growing up turned out to be third line centers, and that's probably the place for him. But Kane, though, if he decides he wants to go, I mean, then to me, you got to take this right down to basically, it's a gut rehab. You take it right down to the wood.
You and I have talked about this. I'd have a lot of respect for Kane right now as if he just went to them and said, I want out. Because
I couldn't blame him. I mean,
I couldn't blame him.
He wants to be the best American player ever. I mean, you know, and if he's going to put the time in, let's face it. If you take yourself away from the off-ice stuff, Kane's never bitched and moaned. He's played with players that really no one else would play with or couldn't play with. He's made other players better, except for maybe this year. He's grown as a player every year. And even when you look at it, even when I say except for this year, he's got 74 points in 60 games. So, you know, I think, but if not, I mean, they got to take it right to the studs. You might as well just go right away and trade DeBrincat. And then you look to trade Seth Jones, too. Because what's the chances of DeBrincat doing as good without a Kane-like player? And you just can't manufacture those players. I'm not saying DeBrincat isn't a good player. But they go together pretty well when they do play together. At least they get a lot of power play points. I don't know. It's a tough call.
Because if he goes, Rocky Wirtz loses 5,000 fans a game, I'll say. And I don't think that's exaggerating from this year to next if he were to go. And I think if you put numbers to that, that's going to be at $300,000 plus a game, which is going to go beyond what he would pay Kane. So what they should do is they should sit down and say, hey, listen, you know, what are you thinking? What do you want to do? And they should sign him to an extension and a team-friendly deal.
Well, what they
should have done. You have him under some control, right? Well, what they should have done is talk to him already, but they didn't do that to either guy.
Yeah, it's another reason why Danny Wirtz, this is too much for him. He's overwhelmed and he's not capable of doing this. Because I blame Danny Wirtz for this more than I do Kyle Davidson, but both of them. Because it's so embarrassing to me that, Mark Lazarus gets to Taves and after the Brandon Hagel trade, and which is the most, I mean, you could have predicted this, right? Because that's the go-to move for him. And so what do you think about this Brandon?
Yeah.
What do you think about this Brandon Hagel trade? And then Taves is blindsided by it. He's like, I don't know. I got to reevaluate. Like, you know, that's coming. So forget that. The right thing to do from the beginning would have been before the trade deadline starts to get underway, before you start making moves, take each individually, take those guys out to dinner. If they want to bring their agent, they can bring their agent, whatever. But take them out to dinner. It's Kyle, it's Danny, if Rocky wants to be there, Taves, you know, whoever else is important to him to be there. And just sit down and just say, this is what we're thinking. This is how we think this is going to play out. Give us your thoughts. We want to know what you're thinking at this stage. You want to come back. You want to follow up to us. But if you want out, let us know. I don't know that we can do that now. Maybe that's something we could do over the summer. But we want what you want. And just get on the same page with the player. Do the same thing with Kane. Because if I'm them, it's just like with Fleury. Like this whole thing about like, oh, you know, they did what was best for Fleury. No, they didn't. They treated him like garbage. Like, oh, if if Bill Guerin, if you don't give me a first round draft pick, I'm going to play him and let him get hurt. like that's not respecting the player. The player agreed. Marc-Andre Fleury, for all, like, he didn't want to go anywhere else but Minnesota, and that's like another thing. Well, a really nice guy, right? But that's it. That's his. He had that right. He only go to that place. And you're going to try to make a deal. You're going to get a deal. The deal is there to be made, but you had to act like a big shot, Kyle Davidson. And in the turn, you almost, like, you risk this guy getting hurt and then not being able to go and play for another Stanley Cup potentially. You don't respect the player. Just like you're not respecting Taves and Kane by going to them before you start making moves, and then you let the media get to them first. That's not respecting the players. They got a lot. They really got a lot to improve on there. And it's rudimentary stuff. I mean, you can't really, it just boggles my mind how terrible they are at this.
Well, you know what it is too. And if you look at it, they treated Corey Crawford like a bag of crap.
That's another one.
Two Stanley Cups in the minors for 5 years. And they didn't let him know to the 2 days before free agency started that he wasn't coming back. Okay, now if you consider him one of the core guys, they haven't caught any flack for getting rid of a core player. Brent Seabrook had to go because of injury. Hossa went early because of injury. Duncan Keith, yeah, there was the stuff about his son, and you know, I'm not saying that didn't matter. I mean, although he didn't go necessarily to the closest place to be with his son, I don't think, going to Edmonton, but he didn't want to be here from the standpoint, I've heard this from people, he didn't understand what Colleton was trying to do.
He never liked
that
Colleton
he didn't want
from
to
the
do
very
it.
Beginning.
He, just didn't make,
he never liked him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it didn't make much sense as to what he was wanting to do. And what I heard was he said also that the defenseman that they got coming in won't understand what Colleton's trying to do. And you know what? Ding, 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 ding. That's correct. Because all they had to do was put a guy in who didn't try to big brain it, and things improve subsequently. So they didn't take any heat for Duncan Keith going.
And the other thing, too,
really
real quick about Colleton, I'll let you finish.
Go ahead.
Is Seabrook was a big part of keeping that room together, because that room was always on the verge of complete collapse under Colleton from the very beginning. Remember that game against Winnipeg where he two or three weeks into his into him being the coach, and he questioned all their manhood. This guy that's never done a damn thing is questioning all these four or five guys that have won Stanley Cups. I mean, that room was always on the verge of collapse, and it was Seabrook that really kept it together. And then once he wasn't there anymore, forget about it.
Well, yeah, and correct. And the other thing too is that they didn't have to be the bad guy for any of that stuff. So now, what are you going to do now? Are you going to wait for these guys to get so disgusted that they're going to say, yeah, we want to go? Or do you treat them with some kind of respect and say, this is what we're going to do? Now, I think if you were really – hindsight is 20/20. If you were going to rebuild and wanted to get worse to get better – and I'm not saying, like, take it down to the studs, gut rehab. The player you would have dealt was Duncan Keith 3 years ago.
Right.
Because his contract was a gift, all right? And that would have guaranteed you're probably not going to be better, but you gives an opportunity for a younger guy to come up or whatever. But they didn't do any of that, okay? So now – you look at, like, these people saying, yeah, trade Kane. He's going to be 38 by the time they're good. First off, no one knows the timing. Talon was a very good scout, Dudley. It took Wirtz losing $20 million or so a year for a number of years to bottom out, to accumulate enough draft picks, and they had no consciousness, no idea all those guys were going to get so good at once. And I'll say this for Stan Bowman. I'll never see it again in my lifetime. And I don't know if it'll ever happen again in the foreseeable future in the next 50, 100 years. For a team to lose as many players and to turn over as many players as they did after the first cup and then go on to win two more. And they lost players every time. So he was a hole plugger. But what did that take? That took how many Hall of Fame players, a goaltender that was way underrated, a Nicholas Jalmerson who could have been a number one on a lot of teams. They had Keith and Seabrook in place before they got a lot of the younger guys coming up. And they were blessed by the Lord to fall into Kane, and Talon picked the right guy twice in Taves and Kane. So all of that melds together. And the enormous amount of money that the old man lost to really make it happen. These rebuilds, there's always a quarter of the teams or so in some state of rebuild. There's teams that are bad that stay bad for decades. Buffalo, you could just again and again, okay? But you need to know what you're doing. It's not just getting draft picks. It's knowing how to draft, what to do with them, when to add to the mix, having a coach that garners the respect, teaching a system that works, that becomes a plug-and-play thing, so that when you do get injuries, like the Penguins have had over the years, teams like Washington, teams like Boston, they could plug and play. They're so far away from that unless they really focus on the infrastructure that that's what discourages me as much or more. And I think if a guy like Kane looks at it and Taves, they may see the same and say, what chances do they have to be relevant in the next 5 years? And, you know, maybe they'll go. But if Kane goes, there's a lot more. There's going to be a lot of empty seats anyway. There's a lot more if he goes, and it's going to cost them. So then it'll be interesting to see who they deal next and try to keep going with it, because you might as well strip it down then at that point. But we'll see.
All right, we can talk about that more. We'll do another one of these in a couple of weeks. But before we go, we got about 10 minutes left. I do want to talk about Kyle Beach. But first, the Blackhawks town hall and the absolute castration of the Chicago media by Rocky Wirtz. I gotta say this and try to run through this quickly. I did not watch that town hall live. But as it was going on, I was sort of scrolling through Twitter and I saw Rocky Wirtz, the transcription of him going off on Mark Lazarus. And I know, full disclosure, I know Mark Lazarus a little bit. I like Mark. I know he's not everybody's cup of tea, but I think he's a great writer. I think he's really good at what he does. But I think he woefully, I understand why he handled it the way that he did, and I'll get into that, but I think he woefully underperformed that day. Watching or just seeing it on Twitter, I was like, I had the same reaction that a lot of people did, like, wow. Like, and my reaction was, they had 4 months to prepare for this, and this is what they came out with? And I was appalled, too, because it's like, this is insensitive. I had all those same reactions. And then I watched it, and I had a completely different reaction. Because, you know, Danny Wirtz, like, tries to interrupt and say, oh, I'd love to talk about this. Bullshit. He had 45 minutes of that town hall to talk about that. And they elected not to. It was their town hall. They set the topics. They got to decide what they talked about for 45 minutes before they threw it to the media. They didn't talk about it. They waited until they called on the media. And the important context here is that a few days before that town hall, The Athletic, Powers and Lazarus, put out an article about all these questions that they were going to have for the Wirtzes at the town hall, right? So if you're the Wirtzes, right, you know exactly, when you call on Lazarus, you know exactly what he's going to ask. There's no mystery here. They call on Lazarus. And this is where my opinion of this changed. And they ask, Mark stands up, and he asks about, he doesn't ask directly about Kyle Beach, but he referenced it. And then what going forward, are you know, the changes that you're putting in place. And Rocky Wirtz says, I'll take that. And if you watch the body language, he scoots up in his seat, and it's like he's been waiting months to let this out. And he just eviscerates Mark Lazarus. And it was the what he said was ridiculous. And but I watched this and I go, this is brilliant. It's terrible, but from his perspective, what the Wirtzes were trying to accomplish was they don't want to talk about this. And by him lashing out in that way and being so ridiculous and such an appalling person, all those things are correct. And Lazarus just stands there and he asks, I think he said, like, you have another question? And Lazarus says, no, I think you said enough, and he sits down. And I'm watching the video and I'm looking at Mark and I know what's happening in Mark's head because I've been in that situation where you're that column is already written. Rocky Wirtz has done the work for you. It's the column is done. All he has to sit down now is and write it. His day's done. Mark should have followed up and asked a different question about the same topic. Somebody else in that should have got up and said, are you still paying Stan Bowman? At what point did you – like, was there ever a consideration to fire Stan Bowman based on performance? Why did you wait, like, until the Jenner and Block report came out to fire Stan when you could have just walked down the hall and asked him? All of these different questions that they could have asked in that moment, but they did – Rocky pulled a Trump, and that he lashed out, and everyone's like, oh, my God, how appalling. You see how he behaves? And they forgot to ask the questions. They forgot to get into the substance. And he completely neutered the media, and he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. He didn't want to talk about it. Now, the thing that I would argue, though, is that, and this is another reason why Jamie Faulkner and Danny Wirtz are totally incompetent and they're not capable of this, is that you could have had your cake and ate it too. You could have started off that town hall and said, you know, we know that we haven't had a chance, or you know, you could say that, but it would be a lie. We haven't been out in front of the media. We haven't talked a lot since the Jenner and Block report came out. And you could have just laid out whatever you wanted to say and addressed it and moved on. Because Mark Lazarus, when he gets called on, is still going to get up and ask his question. So for the people that want to hate the media, that would have played right into them. They address it at the top. Mark gets up, asks his question, then Rocky lashes out. So the people that want to hate the media and want to hate Mark, they can. That's there for them. Oh, that's fake media. They talked about it, and they want to rehash old stuff. That would have been there for them. So he could have had his cake and ate it too, but they didn't think of that because they're not smart enough to think of that. And it's amazing to me that, I mean, people, and now it's just like it's past news. Like, no one's talking about it. No one's writing any articles about it. And, you know, it's so frustrating.
Lazarus, Scott Powers, those guys work very hard. And I know, like, I was never a beat writer, never pretended to be a beat writer. But I was around and I saw what they need to do to make a living. And you have to walk a fine line. Because the message is controlled, probably in hockey more so than anything else, being sports-wise, I think, although I'm not qualified to really say that because I never covered any other sports, but it's tightly controlled. You can't just go and pick up the phone and say, hey, I want to talk to Stan Bowman. You have to wait. And so a lot of times you have to be careful. The people that you could talk to on a regular basis, you have to be careful when the hammer comes out, you know. But in this case, as you were saying, the thing that was disappointing to me was that Mark sat down.
Yeah.
See, because he threw up, he worded it, and he's a bright guy. It was a softball question, and he worded it in a way that the organization, the people up there, should have smiled. They should have embraced it. They should have had an answer. He had a canned answer. But what Rocky did was, and it wasn't because he lost his temper. It wasn't because it was a knee-jerk reaction. It was exactly what he wanted to happen because he wanted to control the message. and he wanted to intimidate. So,
and he can, and the other thing is he can take the hit. It's like good cop, bad cop. Rocky can take the hit because he knows
right because the other young guys.
Gary Bettman can't do anything
right,
to
right.
him.
Gary Bettman can't do anything to Rocky Wirtz. Right.
And Danny gets to pull the reporters aside and say, hey, I would love to talk to you about this.
Right.
It's good cop,
right.
bad cop.
And really, people that – right. And people that aren't old enough to realize, he became his father. See, his father would do things like that with the media and the gentleman from the Tribune who had a backbone to ask something – where they cut his legs out from under him because they told him to go to the ticket office to ask the question or whatever, however he phrased it. That's what Bill Wirtz would do. When Bobby Hull, when they chose not to sign him to the $1 million contract and WGN lost interest or wanted to change their deal or stop showing all their games or some of their games, he blamed the media. He blamed the media for not putting scores in the paper. Well, you know, papers were on a deadline. The Hawks were notorious for having long-running games, and that had to do with the fact that they'd stretch out for years. They would stretch out in between the periods another 3 or 4 minutes each time so that they could sell more beer. And they finally got reprimanded with that when there were more eyes on them and games were televised because their games would run longer. But the point of it is he would always say things like, we're not covered properly in the papers. We're not given, they don't get the scores in. They don't represent us on TV. He always made an enemy in the media, and he did whatever he wanted to do, and he cut his nose to spite his face. And he disintegrated the fan base because he lost generations of people, because when you lose the kids, the father, you lose the kid, and it goes on and on and on. The one brilliant thing he did was when he did the student entry for $7 or $8 with a student ID, he captured the kids, the young adults, who became season ticket holders in years later. The point being is that he turned into his father. He controlled the narrative. He basically intimidated and took control. And it's him. It was on him. It wasn't his son. Wasn't Jamie Faulkner. But it was just a poor display all the way around. And it almost shows you that, is the right hand know what the left hand's doing?
Well, the other thing,
and
too, is
that's what's scary with this stuff.
From a fan perspective, sports fanaticism is the most ridiculous thing going in society. Fans that were so appalled about, you know, to learn what happened with Aldrich and how the way the Blackhawks handled it, they're still all watching. They're like, a lot of them are still going. The Blackhawks fans, all they were looking to from the Wirtzes was to simply lie to them and tell them that everything is better now. So the fan can justify their investment emotionally or financially in this team because they're passionate about it. It's something that they love. It's a distraction from whatever else that they got going on in their life. It's something that they love. And it's going to be hard to just disassociate from it. They don't want to disassociate from it. So just lie to me and tell me that everything is better now. And they wouldn't do it. Rocky Wirtz wouldn't do it. Because that's the arrogance of these people. Is that at the end of the day, Rocky's pissed because he took that team from his brother. And a lot of it boils down to just that. He took that team from his brother because the Wirtz name in this city, despite all of its business success, the Wirtz name in this city was garbage. And Rocky took it over, not just to take it over and turn the team around and potentially win Stanley Cups, which they did, but he also did it for the betterment of the Wirtz Corporation, right? He did it to boost the Wirtz name and the value of the Wirtz brand in the Chicago market, and he did it. And then along came this Jenner and Block report. Along came John Doe, turned out to be Kyle Beach, drudging up this old stuff. And now he's back in the gutter. And he's spent all that money, and he's pissed, and he's lashing out. And when all he really needed to do was just relent and just say, we're sorry, and tell people that it's all better now, even if it's a lie. and he couldn't do it. He didn't have it in him because he's the victim. And that's what that town hall was all about. That's what that outburst was all about. Rocky feels like he's the victim, and he's pissed. We're running
out
of time.
He's getting sued. It's costing him a lot. Yeah, it's costing him a lot of money, and he didn't know anything about it.
Well, that's the other, and we're running out of time, but I want to
we'll
cover that
yeah.
Jenner and Block report, because there's a nugget in that Jenner and Block report that it's impossible, and it doesn't get investigated. It's just dropped. It's impossible to believe that he didn't know. But we got to go. Al, thank you very much for doing this. I got to clean up some stuff in post-production. We had some connection issues, but I'll do that. We'll do it again another week or so. There's so much to cover. But for everybody, thanks for listening. Hopefully people listen to this, and hopefully you'll join us again in another couple of weeks. Thanks, Al. Chris Bach, Al Samaglia. Thanks, everybody.